This is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. I'm Divya Shekhar. Today we are going to discuss The Founders, which is the origin story of payments platform PayPal. The business biography written by Jimmy Soni chronicles how PayPal has shaped the modern internet landscape, and it features interviews and backstories of all the PayPal co-founders, including Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, and Max Levchin, who are called the PayPal Mafia and are among the most influential people in Silicon Valley today. Jimmy is the former managing editor of the Huffington Post. He was earlier a consultant with McKinsey and a speechwriter at the office of the mayor of the District of Columbia in the US. His previous award-winning book was a biography of mathematician Claude Shannon that was co-authored with Rob Goodman. Jimmy has spent more than 6 years of his life researching and writing about PayPal and the story of the rise to power of its founders. Thank you for joining us today, Jimmy.
Well, thank you very much for having me and for that very kind introduction.
So your book is not about one person, but how a group of people, you know, who are today some of the most powerful and influential people in Silicon Valley came together at a point in time to build a company that revolutionized the consumer internet as we know it today. But as we speak, there's this saga unfolding of the $44 billion takeover of Twitter by Elon Musk. You've also spoken about his fondness for the letter X and, you know, how he formed X.com and how he wants to build this everything app. And even in the biography of Musk, I think Ashley Vance wrote that Musk has set about building something that has the potential to be much grander than anything Howard Hughes or Steve Jobs have produced. And do you agree with that assessment based on your conversation with him?
You know, let me answer the question in two ways. The first is, I agree with the statement, but it applies to space and SpaceX. To take a step back, for listeners who aren't following the kind of daily drama, and to be candid, I'm not following all of it either, but Elon had issued a tweet that basically said that part of the Twitter acquisition is the first step to building X, the everything app, which is sort of, in my understanding, sort of supposed to be like what WeChat is in China. Now, I live in New York in the United States of America. I'm not familiar with WeChat, so I don't know quite what that means. This is not the area I researched, but my understanding is that it does messaging, it does payments, it does a little bit of everything, right? There was, when Elon was getting started with PayPal, he bought a domain called x.com. And x.com was one of the, what was basically half of the company. And PayPal, the PayPal we know, is the fusion of two companies, his x.com and Peter Thiel and Max Levchin's Confinity. For him, x.com was supposed to be all things financial at that time. So he wanted to unite, let's say, savings accounts, checking accounts, brokerage, mortgage, all things financial, because his belief was that if you did that, you'd be able to save consumers money. And as he put it to me, he said, well, if all the money is in one place, then why would you need to put the money anywhere else? You know, he sort of wanted to change finance. That was then. I think now we have different technologies and he's adapting this vision to what exists today. I don't have the kind of research or background to know if it'll be successful. But I think the statement that Ashley made applies very much to SpaceX. I think the idea is that in reducing the cost of space travel, he wants to make it possible for humankind to explore new planets, to build on new planets, and to basically expand human civilization, right? To make it so that Earth is not the only place we call home. I'm not a researcher, but it would seem to me that that is a very big ambition. Whether it is on the scale of Steve Jobs, I mean, I think you could fairly argue that it's bigger than what Steve Jobs wanted to do, right? There's a big difference between rockets and my iPhone, you know?
I know that it's 6 years of your life, but for our listeners who might not be familiar with the merger of X.com and Confinity and how it led to the birth of PayPal, and when we say PayPal revolutionized consumer internet, could you sort of crunch that up and, you know, talk about what that means?
Yeah, I think there's a part A and a part B, and in some ways the part B is the one that your listeners will be most familiar with. So if your listeners have watched a YouTube video, if they've read a review on Yelp, if they've ever used LinkedIn, they are tied in some way back to the founders of PayPal, all of whom came from that company. There are the first outside money into Facebook, the first outside money, if I remember correctly, into Twitter, Tesla, SpaceX, obviously, Palantir. You can tie back company after company to the founders and early employees of PayPal. And so, look, subtitles are what they are, right? Whether it sort of made the modern internet, I don't know, you know, but I do think that there was a type of a template for entrepreneurship that was built at PayPal that was used in the creation of, for example, YouTube, right? And how many, I mean, at this point, it must be at least a trillion, some huge number of video views, right? And media transmitted that way. And then at the same time that YouTube is still successful and still taking, you know, off, you have satellites beaming internet down to Ukraine and Iran based on another PayPal founder. So the idea of the internet being transformed by these people, I don't think that's much of an exaggeration. That's part B, what came later. Part A is that they all worked between 1998 and 2002 at these two companies that in the year 2000 became one company, and that one company had a product called PayPal. PayPal at the time became the most successful payment system so that I, Jimmy, could send you, Divya, like $10 or $20 if I bought something from you. We think of that as a very commonplace, ordinary transaction, not very fancy. Oh, who cares, right? But actually, that was a big deal. That was a transaction that was hard to do, mostly because it was hard to fight the fraud and to create the ingredients so that that transaction happened safely, securely, and that neither one of us was defrauding the other. That was PayPal's great and lasting contribution to the internet.
You've called PayPal a startup under siege, you know, and how in the wake of the dot-com bust, it faced an intensely competitive market, both from the new startups as well as legacy credit card companies and multi-billion dollar banks. So there was a lot of intense pressure for survival and pressure for success. How did that lead or contribute to the making of the company, as well as the founders into the powerhouses that they are today?
Yeah, it's. I should say, Divya, it's always good to be interviewed by somebody who's actually read the book. This is, so I appreciate you asking good questions and actually having taken time to go through it. So if we go in a time machine and we go back to 1998 and 1999, you know, you have internet companies. Everybody is starting an internet company. If you attach .com to anything, you can raise a few million dollars. And it's a very heady time. It's a very frothy time. That music stops in the year 2000. So in March of 2000, some of your listeners will remember, we go through what's in the US was called the bursting of the dot-com bubble. And what happens is that all of these companies that didn't really have a business model, that didn't really have much, suddenly fall. The NASDAQ stock exchange in the US drops 86% during the course of that year. You know, billions of dollars are of market cap are wiped away in a second. And a lot of companies die. I mean, a lot of the companies that we knew then that were supposed to be successful, a good example is pets.com, was supposed to change how we ordered pet food. It is gone by the end of the year, right? Dissolved. PayPal is created right at the tail end of 1999, really. And by March of 2000, they've closed $100 million of financing, which was a big round at the time. And a few weeks later, the market starts this slide. And so here's what happens. The company is losing money because of fraud. It's losing money because of overhead. They have $100 million. There's no more money coming, at least not right away. And they have to figure out how to make the company survive. That intense pressure is part of what made the company successful, because they had to figure it out. They had to very quickly, you know, it wasn't sort of they could go play foosball or go play ping pong and like have a nice lunch and then go. It was 7 days a week trying to keep the company alive. And that produced a number of incredible innovations, especially in fraud fighting. So that's kind of the first half of the answer to your question, which is for PayPal, the pressure became productive, right? You know, they made some of the contributions that people still use to this day. And for listeners, if you don't believe me, if you've ever used a CAPTCHA test, if you've ever had to identify, you know, a fire hydrant or a road or a bridge among a series of pictures to prove that you're a human being, you can thank PayPal for that nuisance, right? They created and commercialized that technology. as a way of separating robots from humans so that they could fight fraud. Part B is that the idea of a startup being difficult but doable, even under duress and pressure and difficulty, this whole generation of entrepreneurs took that into what they were doing in the future. And so, you know, if you can think about the founders of YouTube, for example, there were other video services, just like there were other payment services. But the YouTube founders thought, you know, we can do this better and faster and more aggressively. And I can give, you know, some stories as well about the, how aggressive they were. But that's the piece of it, is that pressure sort of like a diamond, right? Like they produced these real innovations under duress.
You describe the work culture, the intense work culture at PayPal, and you say that it was a haze of exhaustion, adrenaline, and anxiety. What does this say about how these founders run their businesses? You know, especially if you put it in the context of today, where we are also seeing this sort of emergence of an anti-hustle culture.
Yeah. Oh boy, what a good question. And I'll tell a story that's not in the book about this. So I had planned to meet with Musk, my first meeting, on a Friday afternoon, late afternoon. And there had been some layoffs that day, I think at either SpaceX or Tesla. And his team called me and said, listen, things have gotten really crazy. How flexible are you? And so I said to them, look, I only booked a one-way ticket here because I knew something like this could happen. So you tell me what works for him. So they said, why don't you go to his house tomorrow, Saturday, at like 1 o'clock? And he can talk to you then. And I said, great. And I'm still expecting something's going to happen. You know, it's his life. Like, I get it. I would have forgiven him if he needed to cancel on me. But I show up at his home at 1 o'clock on a Saturday. And it's a beautiful day in Los Angeles. And I kind of walk into this house. We're sort of in the foyer area. And he emerges and he shakes my hand and I shake his hand. And then he turns and starts walking to what is his living room. And he looks at me, he didn't say anything to me. So I didn't know what to say because this was our first interaction. There's a little bit of an awkward silence. And so I said, I didn't know what to say. So I said, Elon, thank you for doing this. And I really appreciate you doing it on a Saturday because, you know, it's a Saturday. So thanks. And he doesn't even look at me. And he says, well, I work 7 days a week, so whatever. and it was this amazing thing of like, here is this, you know, at the time, I think he was like 49 or something. And even in that moment, this like 49-year-old, very successful, you know, in his house, and he's telling me that he works 7 days a week, even then, even at this point in his life, right? But I laugh about it today, but there's total truth to it. This group as a whole, they work very, very hard to bring these things into creation. Now, I don't think all of them work this way. Not everyone I interviewed is this way. But, you know, Max Levchin and Elon Musk, this is the thing that they feel driven to do, is to build these companies. And that is it for them, at least in that, at that point in their life, when I was writing about them at PayPal, it was a 7-day-a-week affair. And so there's this tension, right? Because you have, like, fundamentally, you have people who see the hustle culture as central to success, as like, this is actually a part of what we do well. And then I think in the 20 years that have passed since, we've also kind of learned more about how that might be counterproductive, or how it might pick, you know, some people can't participate in that culture. It's hard for, I think, anyone to square that circle. I imagine that over time, particularly as both of them have become parents, that they've both probably like moderated just a little, at least for people who have sort of children and families. But I don't think it's much of an exaggeration, especially if you read some of the accounts of early SpaceX. It's hard. It's hard to create new things in the world. And the idea of it being all consuming, I mean, it's hard to separate from a startup. I actually had somebody, it's funny you asked this question. I had somebody email me who had read the book. He knows all of the people involved. He is professionally very tied into their lives. And he said to me, and Silicon Valley in general, and he said, I'm glad you did not run away from how hard the work of a startup is and how many hours it takes. He says, because when I tell people that, I get a lot of sort of hate on Twitter. But he said, but you're accurately capturing the difficulty of going up against incumbents, banks, financial institutions, like how difficult it is when you're fighting a competitor that has much more capital. He said, it simply just required that we work on Friday and Saturday nights.
Jimmy, while working on the book, you got access to internal communication, hundreds of people associated with the company, and most importantly, all the founders, from Elon Musk and Peter Thiel to Max Levchin and Reid Hoffman, who, as you say, work 7 days a week. So how long did that take?
It took a long time. This book took, I did 275 interviews over roughly six years. A lot of blind alleys and trying to get to people and then not having them respond and then having them respond later, that kind of thing. It started with Peter Thiel. He's the first person I went to. And I went to him because, you know, he's one of the kind of co-founders. He is plugged in with all of these people. And my kind of feeling was if he said no, then it was a bad idea, then everybody else would say no too, you know? And what I would say is that the process was, there are two processes. One is the manual process of reaching out to people. So I went from person to person. I mean, honestly, it was, I would meet with Peter and then he would say a name and I would say, would you be able to make an introduction to that person? And there were certain people I knew that if I reached out to them and it was not through an introduction, there'd be no access, right? And so Reid Hoffman's an example. Like I needed someone to introduce me to him because he's so busy and he gets so much thrown at him that, you know. So that was kind of one, was just like very manual. The second is I sent a lot of cold emails. You know, there's a reason that there's a lot of names in the book that no one's ever heard from before are because I just would reach out to them and they would say to me, oh, no one's ever asked me about my PayPal time before. And so that was part of it. And along the way, what happened is that people opened up to me and they shared various kind of documents or emails, or kind of one person shared an entire like kind of archive of emails, right? And together I was able to just build this kind of infrastructure as I went along. But I would say that it took years to even just earn the trust of people to say, okay, listen, I'm not like a person who's looking to embarrass you. I want to understand when you were in your 20s, why did you choose to join this company? What did you do there? How did that work influence your later life? So I think what they're accustomed to frequently are people who are looking to like get them, you know, like, oh, I'm going to get you. I'm going to find this thing. And I was interested far more in the question of in the universe of things they could have done with their lives. Why do this and not something else? And then what actually happened there? Like, what are the mechanics of building a company? Those questions, once you get over some initial skepticism, have very interesting answers. And it just took a little while to kind of earn the trust that, look, you know, this is about something that happened 20 years ago. And I want to understand, like, what was in your head when you were doing that?
Jimmy, this brings me to the table of contents of your book. Why do you use chess terms like Sicilian defense, bad bishops, and double rooks to narrate a business story?
Yeah, you're the first person to pick up on that. And I've never had the chance to talk about it in an interview before. So I'm very glad to. But, you know, I have, I wanted these characters, these people are very different. You know, they are unique, like in the truest sense of the word. You know, it's very hard to find carbon copies of these people in the world, right? Contrast that, for example, with like a public company CEO at any other company. I don't know the names of the CEOs of Ford or GM, and I'm sure they're great executives, but they're not kind of these like figures the way that, you know, a Max or an Elon or Peter are. I wanted to do a little something to like kind of have like things in the book that physically tracked to the people. And a few of the people in this story are good chess players. One, Peter Thiel, is a very, very good chess player. He was once like the top player under 13 in the United States. I mean, he's a very big deal in the chess world in his day. But the others are good players as well. And so I had this idea that like the book has three parts. What if each of the parts was a specific sequence of chess moves that had some illusion or like, you know, kind of analogized the situation? Now, the more interesting thing I buried in the book, and I won't give away the secret, but I actually buried a secret code in the book. So there's a multi-hundred page secret code that is in the book, and it has like a reveals a message, and only a few people have actually solved it. But there is a secret code in the book, and that is because Max Levchin's great passion in life is code breaking. He really enjoys it. He enjoys puzzles. He enjoys that kind of thing. And I was like, you know, I want to bury a code in the book, and then I want to see if he, and what's funny is as soon as I told him there was a code, he spent the next 2 days cracking it and solved it and sent me the answer.
You know, that's a really interesting anecdote, which now brings me to the PayPal Mafia moniker. You write in the book that several billionaires and many multimillionaires have emerged from PayPal's ranks. The group's combined net worth is higher than the GDP of New Zealand. So could you talk about the PayPal Mafia moniker, which is associated with the founders? It does have a negative connotation to it, but the mafia term has since been used while referring to powerful startups across the world. In India, for example, there are mentions of the Flipkart Mafia in the e-commerce space.
Yeah. So my story, you know, the last chapter of the PayPal part of my story ends in 2002. And what happens in the aftermath is that you have this group of people who have made some money from PayPal. They've also seen that the internet can be successful, as opposed to people who in the dot-com bubble bursting said, oh, the internet, like, it's over. Nothing's going to happen. They start to make investments in other internet companies. A lot of those companies are being created by their friends and former coworkers at PayPal. And so, for example, Reid Hoffman creates LinkedIn. Well, the money from LinkedIn comes from other people who worked with Reid Hoffman at PayPal, in part. You know, you have Yelp. Yelp is created by two people, Russ Simmons and Jeremy Stoppelman, PayPal alumni. The first money into Yelp comes from Max Levchin. As the years go by, those companies start to be successful. And a kind of like mystique emerges around the PayPal alumni group. In 2006, there's an article, I think it was in Forbes, where the writer refers to them as the PayPal diaspora. In 2007, Fortune magazine does a cover photo, and the headline is the PayPal Mafia. And so that sticks because there's this kind of iconic photo of these people dressed up in mafia, you know, kind of gangster gear in an Italian restaurant, right? And it becomes iconic. And what it does is it makes people think like, oh, like this is so like, you know, it's so nefarious. It's not nefarious. It's that they were helping each other kind of in the aftermath of their first success. They became friends, advisors, they served on each other's boards, right? You know, this goes even today. To this day, Luke Nosek, who first met Elon through PayPal, serves on the SpaceX board. You know, there's all of these relationships. And so what has happened is around the world, when a company has had a successful exit, people will immediately ask the question, you know, is this going to be the Flipkart Mafia? Is this going to be the Copo Mafia? Is this going to be the Workbrain Mafia? And so that's become a thing. And I think what it implies is not that they're going to go out and like become a crime syndicate. I think what it implies is, you know, is this going to be a group that furthers the ecosystem of technology companies in this particular country or in this particular domain? And my understanding, although limited, is that Flipkart, many of its founders and creators have either invested in or created new startups. And so there is that emerging, right? And so that's where it comes from. Now, I will say people, even within the alumni group, people were pretty divided on the mafia thing. Some people really like it and some people really hate it. I think the best description or the best joke came from John Malloy, who was a board member. And he told me, he's like, oh, describing us as mafia, that's giving us too much credit. A mafia is far better organized than we were at the time.
You know, my next question is not directly related to the book, but I wonder, at the time that you spoke with Peter Thiel, did you anticipate his emergence as a right-wing power player?
You know, we were talking, when did I start talking to him? It was around the time, I think, when Trump was beginning to run, maybe. He's always been a Republican. I mean, there's kind of no secret about that. But that, you know, what's interesting is that subject did not come up during our discussions. And the reason is because it's not relevant to understanding what happens between 1998 and 2002. And so it was interesting because I also, you know, maybe this is part of the reason that they were willing to talk to me is because it didn't really matter to me what happened between 2016 and 2022 in their lives. It's interesting, you know, in fact, I'll give you a story. I actually tried to block like most of the news about these people that came while I was writing. And this was really hard because my friends would always text me things, you know? But I would say like, don't send me articles about, you know, this or that about Elon or Peter, because in order to tell this story accurately, you actually have to sort of like, you can only be bound by kind of like what you would have known at the time, right? Now that's hard. It's never perfect, but I actually tried to sort of keep a distance from like, oh, this person is like doing this today, right? It was much more about like, all right, let's go back 1999, 2000, 2001. You know, you're not, they're not, you know, there's no success that's guaranteed then. There's no conclusion that we know is going to work well. And so understanding that was very important to me, but it meant actually kind of taking some of what happened in the modern era and saying that's off limits to me.
Finally, to bring this conversation to an end, if you had to share a few quick nuggets from your book that would inspire the younger generation of entrepreneurs, what would those be?
I think the thing, and maybe the most important message, is that we say the name Elon Musk today. We say the name Max Legend today. We say the name David Sachs today, Reid Hoffman, on down the line. In 1999, Max Legend and Peter Thiel were turned down for funding for PayPal over 100 times. They would go into meetings and people would tell them no, or they would laugh at the idea, or they would just simply not even take the meeting, right? Someone called PayPal in 1999 one of the 10 worst business ideas of 1999. When we look at them today, we look at them because they are successful. But that success started somewhere. And for a lot of these people, it started at PayPal. And so I think that the challenge of being a startup entrepreneur, and I come out of this book, by the way, with so much more respect for startup entrepreneurs, particularly young people, where like it's so uncertain and you don't know anything and you're just trying to make it work and you're kind of like your eyeballs are bleeding trying to figure this thing out. Just remember that even the people that we regard today as kind of the Silicon Valley ruling class or titans or these successes, they started at this place where they couldn't even raise money, right, for this idea for a company that is still around 20 years later, right? I think that's really important because the problem with only focusing on the kind of 2022 version of these people is we forget that at one point, Elon Musk did not know whether he should go to Stanford for graduate school, join a company, or start a company. And so I think that that's, to me, the most interesting and probably the most inspiring thing is don't forget that they started with the same uncertainty. And I've actually had a lot of startup entrepreneurs who have read the book who have emailed me or texted me and said, you know, this was like therapy, like because you sort of showed how utterly uncertain it is, even when you are, you know, David Sachs or Reid Hoffman.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Jimmy. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Well, Divya, thank you so much for reading the book so carefully and for taking the time to do the interview.
And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'd love to hear from you. So like, comment, share. Let us know what you think. I'm Divya Shekhar. See you next time.